Welcome to Bill Bronchick's Real Estate Investing Podcast. Mr. Bronchick is an attorney, best-selling author, and a real estate investor with 25 years' experience. For more information and free articles and videos, visit his website at www.legalwiz.com.
All right, so today I wanted to talk about, given that we're in a market where things are kind of volatile, maybe that's not the best term. Uncertain. We're clearly in recession, no matter what the administration wants to call it. Two consecutive quarters of negative GDP. The job market, they say, is looking good. The unemployment is low. But keep in mind that that's not altogether that accurate, because the labor participation rate is way down, because a number of reasons, because some people have just given up. Some people are collecting unemployment and then, working part-time for cash, which is illegal. Some people have started their own business. A lot of people are doing contract work, working from home and doing contract work. So they're technically not employed. So they're not counted in the mix. So there's like about 15 or 20 million fewer people working now than in January of 2020, right before COVID, even though the unemployment rate is almost the same. The job market is pretty good. It was a lot worse, obviously, a year ago. So that's definitely improved. Interest rates, we know have spiked. Although interest rates on mortgages have come down a little bit in the last month. They were upwards of 6 and now they're closer to 5. And the reason for that is a lot of people think that the Fed rate, which is the short-term rate at which banks borrow money, is a direct correlation to mortgage rates. And that's not accurate. Mortgage rates are based on the long-term bond yield. And that fluctuates for a number of factors. I think what it is that mortgage companies are looking at this and saying, okay, they've already baked in the idea that there's been a few raises and there might be probably one more this year. The chances of interest rates going to 9 or something like that, they are unlikely, but you never know. China invades Taiwan and then we have to spend $3 trillion defending them, we're in a very uncertain times right now. A lot of people worried, like, what should I do? It looks like prices are declining all over the place. You see these headlines left and right in the news media about the housing market this and the housing market that. But let's really break that down. They say the number of houses that have sold has come to a halt. Yeah, that doesn't mean the prices have dropped. That just means the number of homes have sold. So houses are sitting a little longer, because what happened was between 2020 and 2021, when there was no sales virtually, because of COVID, there was a lot of pent-up demand and prices shot up, 20 to 30% in some areas. And between 2021 and 2022, people thought they were going to get the same jump. So they listed their houses for way too much. And then that, combined with the interest rate spike and the recession, that has made houses sit a little longer, and sellers are dropping their prices, some of them at least. You see a lot of price drops. I'm getting emailed, price drop this, price drop that. But keep in mind, the actual sales prices are still up substantially from 2021, even though the number of houses that have sold is down. The asking prices are lowered. The average sale price is down over the last few months, but it's still substantially higher from last year. So the question is, what's going to happen from here? Well, to talk about the housing market like that is kind of silly, because housing is not like, say, a commodity like gold pork bellies or, something, or frozen orange juice, if you remember the movie Trading Places. It's where it's the same everywhere and you have no control over it. Housing is local. It's all local. And that's what I really want to focus our discussion on, is the micro local market. When they talk about the housing market nationwide, that doesn't really mean anything to us, because we're not investing nationwide in every city, every state, every county. We don't really care what's going on outside of us. So what's going on in San Francisco and Miami, Chicago, Dallas, San Diego, Burlington, Vermont, all different corners of the, I guess I should include Honolulu and Anchorage. They're all different markets. So what we want to do is dial in what's going on in our market. And when I say our market, I don't just mean our city or our metro area, but the neighborhoods by neighborhoods where you are actually buying, selling, renting. So for example, those of you who are in Colorado, you know that what goes on in Wash Park, one of the nicest neighborhoods in Denver, is not the same thing as what's going on in, let's say, the north end of Commerce City, which is, you know, sort of a, you know, lower end, more of a working class neighborhood, old homes. And, you know, you get good rents, but the values don't spike as they do in Wash Park. And likewise, and, you know, vice versa, you don't get rents commensurate to values in Wash Park. So you buy for appreciation there, you buy for cash flow in the other place. So it really boils down to, you know, neighborhood by neighborhood, like literally subdivision by subdivision or zip code by zip code, however you want to do it. And you want to keep an eye on these four factors that I've listed here. And those are prices, where they are going, where they've been, what's the trend. Remember, the trend is your friend. You got to know the trend. So where are prices going in those particular areas? How much inventory, I mean, how many houses for sale? How many have sold and what they're selling for? And DOM, which is days on market. What is the average days on market for a house in that particular area? And we want to look at these factors on a regular basis. Now, you can get this raw data from Zillow, Redfin, Trulia, and websites like that. You can get raw data. Now, I wouldn't rely on, you know, their market predictors or their articles about things or their opinions or even their opinions of value. You know, they have these automated valuation models. Zillow has what's called a Zestimate, which is, you know, it's a guesstimate based on a mathematical model of what a house is worth. And that's not really, you know, that accurate all the time. So we want to look at their raw data. If you dig in there, you could download raw data, zip code by zip code, county by county, and so forth. And if you have a little trouble, talk to a local real estate broker or agent, and they can get this information from the MLS. So we want to look at these four factors. And again, the four factors are prices, inventory, days on market, and number of solds. And we want to look at that year over year, from this year to the same month last year, month over month. So what's the trend? And then season over season, because remember, you get seasonal fluctuations in a lot of markets. Most markets have seasonal fluctuations because of A, weather, and B, schools. So in most markets, you're going to see a spike in prices in the spring and summer. And then towards the end of the fall, you know, especially between Thanksgiving and Christmas, you're going to see a lull in prices because people are not in the buying market, buying mode during the holiday season as much. And then it picks up again, usually February, March of the following year. So we want to look at, you know, quarter over quarter, season over season, month over month, year after year over year, and extrapolate, you know, what's really going on here? What's really happening in each particular local market? And in particular, there's one particular formula, and some of you know this, I've gone through this in my books and in some of my seminars, the supply curve. So if you don't know it, I want you to take some good notes. If you've heard it before, I'm going to remind you to research this data in your local area and know what the supply curve is for your area. So the supply curve is defined mathematically as the number of houses for sale within a defined geography. And that could be, you know, a subdivision, a submarket, a county, you know, two or three zip codes, one zip code, whatever it is, it just has to be consistent. So it's the number of houses for sale divided by the number of sales within the last 30 days. And when I say sales, it means under contracts. Now, it may not be possible to get the number of under contracts from a source like Zillow. You might have to go to a realtor to get that info. But if you're consistent in the same way and say how many closed in the month, you're going to get roughly the same information, although it's a little behind the curve there because contract to closing is a month or two, could be more depending on where you live. So for as an example, if within a specific area we've defined, there are 30 houses for sale and five sales have occurred in the last 30 days in that area, what is the supply curve? Now, most of you can do basic algebra, 30 divided by 5 is 6, right? 6. So you get 6. 6 what? You know, people, I always do my live seminars, people guess, go 6 properties, 6 houses per month, 6 blah, blah, blah. And they always get it wrong. And the answer is very simple. If no new houses went up for sale, how long would it take to liquidate 30 houses in that area at the rate of 5 per month? And the answer is 6 months. So what the supply curve number is a number of months it would take to liquidate existing inventory. And that's a real number to watch. Now, by the way, 6 months of supply is considered a balanced or normal market. I mean, we're not in a normal market. We haven't been in a normal market for 10 years. We've been in an extreme seller's market. Before that, we were in an extreme buyer's market. Now, if it's more than 6 months, it's taking 7, 8, 9 months to liquidate, then that would be a buyer's market. If it's less than 6 months, especially substantially less, it's a seller's market. Now, nationally, just as a benchmark, we've been at about 1.5 to 2 months supply on average over the last 3 to 5 years, even less the last year. It really doesn't matter because we want to know our local market. Now, that number's increasing. You know, in some markets, I've been doing some research, it's 3 months, 4 months. In some markets, it's 2 months. You know, in Denver, it was as low as 2 weeks, you know, a half, a 0.5 months. In fact, they listed it as zero because the fraction couldn't be done on the software. And because people know, you know, you put a house for sale in most neighborhoods and you have multiple bids within 24 hours and it's under contract within days. But on average, you know, if you look at all the houses in the city, the supply curve was about a half a month. And people are panicking saying, well, the supply has tripled in Denver in the last 6 months. Well, that makes 1.5 months supply. That's still well below 6 months. So it's still a seller's market, although not as much as it was. So the panic of the whole bottom is going to collapse and blah, 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 blah. I just don't see that in most markets. I mean, some markets may adjust, but I think what we're going to see in most markets is just more of a flattening to a normal market where things take, instead of 30 seconds to sell, 30 days. Okay, when you have 4 to 6 months supply and it's a relatively normal market, and that's healthy, that's okay. And you have, you know, 3 to 5, maybe 6 or 7%, depending on where you are, appreciation per year. That's normal. What we've been seeing the last 10 years is abnormal, and it can't sustain itself. You can't have real estate going up at 20% per year when salaries are only going up a few percent, and with inflation at 9, if you believe the number 9, it's actually a net negative for most people's salaries. And of course, that can't be sustained. You know, a lot of people crying about that and saying, oh, it's unfair because people can't buy houses. Houses have become unaffordable. And this affordability index is the number they always use on the national market. And I love that because, first of all, it really doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. And if it does mean something, if it does mean affordability is out of control, then it's a good time to be a landlord. Because if people can't buy houses, if it's unaffordable, then they will rent. And being a landlord is a good thing. Now, this is totally separate from the landlord market. You know, rents are still going up substantially. And the more difficult it is for people to buy homes because interest rates have spiked, the more they're going to rent. And being a landlord is a good thing. So rents are going to go up even more. The fortunate side effect of that is landlords are raising rents so fast to keep up that in some jurisdictions, like in California and in New York City, they've got rent control. And that's coming to the city of Denver. I predict within a year, there's going to be rent control in the city of Denver. Not the state of Colorado, but I think the city of Denver will do it. And the city of Boulder probably will do it as well. Well, you know, as long as they let you get a reasonable increase a year, 5 or 10%, I'm not crying about that because rents are still really, really strong. Okay, so you want to know your supply curve year over year, again, month over month, season over season, and watch that number in the areas that you're investing. Watch that supply curve. What is it doing? What is the trend? Again, the trend is your friend. You've got to know these numbers in those local areas. The micro view of that is evaluating the value of a property, a single property. You know, what is a property worth, whether it's residential or commercial? And there are, you know, various ways to assess that. There's what's called the comparable sales method, which is called comps by most people. The income approach, valuing a property based on what income it produces. The replacement value, what it costs to replace the structure, not the land. And then you've got your tax assessed value down at the county. And then there's various internet websites like Zillow et al. That do automated valuations, and some websites that'll charge you $20 a pop to get a even more detailed, you know, presumably more accurate valuation. The last two are not acceptable methods. The tax assessed value is based on averages. The tax assessor doesn't go house to house and figure out like what a house is worth, your particular house is worth. But they do averages in the area. And that's why you could protest your particular tax assessment every year. So we don't look at that so much. Internet websites, well, you know, if you're totally out of data and you want a total guesstimate, as estimate or whatever, I guess you could look at it. You know, Zillow tends to be fairly on the money in subdivisions that are newer and the houses are very similar. So a subdivision that was like 20 years or 30 years old or less, where there's three or four styles of houses and it's covenant controlled, so there's no, you know, oddball houses, they're fairly accurate. But when you get into a neighborhood where things are totally different, like in downtown Denver or downtown Chicago, you know, where everything is different from block to block, it's really hard to get an accurate number based on an automated valuation model. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. I've seen realtors send out, you know, this is a deal, and they give you Zillow says this, Trulia says that, Redfin says this. So if we average the three, then we get evaluation of X. Well, that's this nonsense. Everybody knows that's nonsense. Garbage in, garbage out. You can't take three inaccurate numbers and average them to a good number. So for single family homes, duplexes, three and four units, up to four units residential, the comparable sales method or comps is the generally accepted approach. For five unit multifamily and up, and other commercial, the income approach is used. So we're going to look at the net operating income of a building, whether it be industrial, whether it be office, whether it be multifamily, it's the same. Now, if you have a duplex that you're going to buy or a triplex or a fourplex, even though the bank's going to use comparable sales, I think you should look at the income approach for yourself just to be able to have a yardstick to measure this threeplex against this threeplex or this fourplex against this fourplex to get a yardstick. The replacement value is usually only used for insurance purposes, although once in a while an appraiser, you know, comes across a house that's really strange, it's a custom build, it's really odd, it's a one-off property, and there's nothing to compare it to, there's no comps. So they may look at replacement value, or they may take all three and then just, you know, weight one more than the other. Usually in residential appraisals, they only use comps. In commercial, they use all three, but they heavily weight the income approach. Okay, so again, what is comparable? What do we mean by comparable? Location to the subject property. So the closer, the better. You really technically can't go more than a mile as the crow flies. Now in Manhattan, that's a long way. It's a lot of neighborhood difference. But you know, in a rural area, a mile may be nothing. I mean, it might be your neighbor. But closer, the better. Age condition of the property, you know, is it built in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 70s, the 80s, or is it, you know, 2000 or newer? If it's built in the 30s, but it's been updated within the last 10 years, then it counts as a newer property. The time sold of the comps. So an appraisal will only go back 6 months of solds. But if you're doing your own analysis, could you look at a house next door to the subject property that sold a year ago and say that's a better comp than the one down the block that sold a month ago? Yeah, sometimes you need to do that. Bedrooms and baths is key. It's three bedrooms versus three bedrooms, two bedrooms versus two bedrooms. Now, two bedrooms and three bedrooms aren't really comparable because the biggest jump in value in a house is between two and three bedrooms. Threes and fours are comparable. Ones and twos are comparable. But twos and threes are generally not. And then baths, you just add or subtract. So if you have a 3-1 and a 3-2, those are comparable. And then you add or subtract the extra or lack of second bedroom. Size usually has to be comparable. It has to be within 25% of the total square footage to be comparable. So a 2-2 that's 1,000 square feet and a 2-2 that's 2,000 square feet really aren't comparable because they're just so there's a 100% difference in size. But a 3-1 that's 1,000 square feet and a 3-1 or 3-2 that's 1,200 square feet are very comparable because it's only 20% difference. And then, of course, style, you know, whether it's a ranch or whether it's a walkout or whether it's a two-story, whether it's a triplex or a raised ranch or a cape or, you know, whatever's popular in your area. And every part of the country has different, like, pecking order of which is the most valuable. So if you go in a hot area like Phoenix, walkout ranches are really popular. You know, you put the bedroom downstairs because it's cooler. Whereas in a cold area, bedrooms on the second floor in a colonial are more popular. So it depends on where you live. Right? And if you have like a basement in Florida, well, that's a problem. That's called a flood. Anyway, so that's it. You know, that's the sort of micro look at things that I wanted to talk about to sort of focus you and dial you in on just ignoring all the noise about the housing market this and the housing market that in a national basis on the news and on social media. It really doesn't matter that much. Only that matters is what's going on in your local area. As long as demand is greater than supply in your local neighborhood, that neighborhood's going to go up. Now, on the other side of town, a half hour away, it might be the opposite. We don't care. The only things that matter nationally are interest rates, lending policies, and tax policy. That affects everybody. Okay, so interest rates being up does affect everybody because it decreases demand for buyers because they have less buying power. Local market where people are moving in because of jobs is different than another market where people are moving out because they don't like crime, you know, like New York City or San Francisco. Compare apples to apples. That's the point. Don't get caught up in the hype. Do the math and do it locally, and you will be golden.
Information and free articles and videos. Visit his website at www.legalwiz.com.